If you have a podcast and want to monetize it, stress-free, you need the Odyssey Creator Lab. We'll host your podcast for free, and our experienced sales team brings in the advertisers and the revenue. Easy. Apply now at creators.odyssey.com and let us show you the money.
Greetings and welcome to Hello Pine Knob, the official podcast for Pine Knob's 50th anniversary. I'm Gary Graff, and throughout the season, we're celebrating by taking a look at Pine Knob's present, and especially its past, revisiting some of the most important events in the theater's history, and talking with some of the folks who made it. After 50 years and more than 3,100 events, there's more than we'll be able to jam into these episodes, but hey, that's why there's a next season. Few bands have made Detroit a second home quite like the J. Geils Band. The Boston group was embraced by Motor City audiences from its first appearance during April of 1971 at the Easttown Theater, and over time the Geils crew played nearly every major venue in the city, from the Grandy Ballroom to Cobo Arena to the Pontiac Silverdome and Ford Field. It also recorded its first live album, Full House, at the old Cinderella Ballroom and portions of the second live set, Blow Your Face Out, at Cobo. Pine Knob was particularly welcoming to the Geils Band as well. Starting in 1979, it played the theater nearly two dozen times. The most memorable was arguably a six-night stand at the beginning of September 1982, which was also the end of the group's touring cycle promoting its multi-platinum Freeze Frame album. The Geils chose Pine Knob to record its third live album, an 11-track set that was released in November of that year called Showtime. It would also be the last Geils release with frontman Peter Wolf. He left the band in 1983, though he would come back to lead reunions and more Pine Knob performances from 1999 on, finishing in 2015. We reached out to Peter at home in New York, and he offered us some memories about recording Showtime and about playing Pine Knob in Detroit in general.
Well, for me, the big distinction is Detroit City. It's playing to a Detroit crowd. Any venue, you can take any venue and put it in Boston or Texas, but there's something about a Detroit crowd. And then you get a Detroit crowd outdoors on a weekend night feeling good, all revved up. It's a hard-driving request from the audience for the band.
Is there anything about Pine Knob itself, just in terms of construction or besides the audience, what kind of, is there anything, I guess, that physically makes it different than others?
Yeah, the audience. The Detroit audience is, you know, for me personally, you know, it's intoxicating. We seem to have a real connection. Even when we did the acoustic thing and we came out and played different venues and stuff, there's just something about a Detroit audience. And again, Pine Knob is special because it contains a great crowd that, you know, really enjoys the music and enjoys, I believe, bands that seem to give 110%.
I did want to focus a little on the Showtime album and recording that there. What was it that led you to do that album there?
I hate to be redundant, because it's the Detroit audience. And Full House, our first live recording, that really was the one that sort of jump-started people getting to know us outside of Detroit and throughout the United States, and even it was very popular in England and Europe. So I remember we were on tour with the Stones, and I was yakking with Charlie Watts, and he was saying, "Oh, you know, I came to see you guys at Midnight Court, and I listened to that Full House album, and I wanted to see that drummer play 99 miles an hour." So Full House was an important thing for us, and sort of that recording led to Blow Your Face Out, which some was done in Boston, which, of course, is hometown, and then other parts of it were done in Detroit, which is second hometown. And so for Showtime, I think Freeze Frame was out, and the record company was looking for something to put out just to have something out, and so it was something that they really wanted, and we said, well, let's do Pine Knob.
Well, sure, and then you were sitting down there for six nights, which I'm sure is more conducive to making a live recording.
It's special when you get into Pine Knob. There's a lot of old friends. Some, unfortunately, are gone. But the way of the world, we, you know, used to have lots of parties afterwards, and then we'd roll off to a hotel and take a top floor and just sort of do what rock and rollers did in those days and come back down or stay up all night and roll back on stage. It was a marathon of music, melody, and joy for me.
What do you remember about the, you know, about those shows and that particular week at Pine Knob?
Well, we were filming, and it didn't quite come out as well as we wanted. We were hoping to do a sort of documentary, and at that point, it was just MTV that weren't doing long-form rock and roll, and it might have even been before VH1 came out. So we were just trying to document Detroit and our being at Pine Knob, and just using it as a way of just staying in Detroit for that period and playing every night.
There was kind of a victory lap feeling to that, too, I remember, because I remember it was the end of that particular tour, and obviously it had been such a huge year with Freeze Frame, with the, you know, Freeze Frame doing so well, you guys being in Europe with the Stones. Did it, you know, I mean, did you feel like the band was in a particularly prime shape then?
You know, we had spent 17 years just sort of just hanging together and battling, and the audiences, Detroit embraced us right away at the East Town and before, but it took a while. I would have to agree with you. It just felt really good, and we went all through Europe. I believe it might have even, some of it might have even started on the West Coast, and that's, I think, where Prince was going to be on the tour. The rockin' audiences there didn't quite understand Prince at that time. I know Nick and I were big fans, and we were sorry that he had problems connecting with the audience, but he was also going to be part of that tour too.
The Showtime album, you know, was of course only part of the show. Was there ever, has there been over the years consideration or thought about putting out the entire show? Or,
well, we were always hesitant on releasing live album and even Full House, because Full House basically had, you know, first and second, the songs were really basically just the first and second albums, and we just thought, you know, people are just going to think there's nothing left. And then when we got to Blow Your Face Out, which was a double record set, there were, you know, that had the Must Have Got Lost rap, which was funny because I remember we recorded that one, I believe, in Detroit, and it was pretty spontaneous, the rap. And I remember being back in Detroit and people yelling out, "Reputa the Buter," and at first I, you know, wasn't sure what they were talking about. I had to go back the hotel that night and try to memorize the rap, because if I veered away from it, you know, the audience didn't like it. They wanted to hear the whole thing. But in answer to your question, I think we had a lot of the songs that we performed that night. There were obviously others, but, you know, most of them were already previously on live recording.
That makes sense. It was funny because I remember on the original vinyl, the rap was on like side one, and then and then the song came on side two.
Yeah, try to figure that one out. And I think, you know, it might have had to do with the length of music you were allowed to have on a side before you started losing bass and stuff. So the thing that people embraced about CD was you could have one or even two albums on one CD. But with vinyl, to make it sound good, you were constrained. There was a time constraint on each side. In the early rock and roll records, and why so many of them sound so good, there was usually six songs a side. So you didn't want to go more than 18 minutes a side. And so as they were cutting discs and it sort of got refined, I think the Stones and certain bands started pushing the edge of how much time you can have on a disc on each side. And then the CD came out, and that sort of, you had like 82 minutes on the whole CD.
Yeah. Now, one of your more memorable solo performances at Pine Knob was opening for Tom Petty that year. What are your memories of that?
I had went to see Tom. He was playing in Boston with Mudcrunch. I hadn't seen him in quite a while. We used to stay in contact, and I even spent some time with Mike Campbell and Tom. We were doing some possibly songwriting and stuff. We just had a connection because they had spent a lot of their first big touring was opening up for the Giles band, and I used to go in the dressing room and sit with them and yak, and so we had a connection real early on. Same like with U2. I think the first time U2 played in an arena was opening up for the Giles band at Cobo Hall, and I remember having to go in the dressing room and speak to the Edge and Bono about what they were going to about. They were so nervous, and I told them, just give it what you got, and the audience will appreciate it. You know, don't worry about if they know your songs or don't know your songs. You know, they love rock and roll, and if you, you know, hit it, they'll appreciate it, and it turned out to be true. But with Petty, I was at Mud Crunch, and we were yakking about the old days and stuff, and Tom mentioned, we were talking about the solo stuff, and Tom had chose some of my solo material to play, you know, in the intermission between the opening act and before the Heartbreakers came on. And so we were just yakking about music and stuff. And then I got a call from his manager saying, look, Tom's doing a tour, and the tour is going to be composed of people to open for him that he, you know, really appreciates and has a certain association with. And he'd wonder if you'd like to jump on some dates. And so that was a big honor for me. I really appreciated it. And also to be with Tom, whose wife comes from Detroit, Dana. And so being at Pine Knob, she had her whole family. And unfortunately, Tom was going through some, you know, he had a broken hip. Most people didn't know it. And I would watch him. He'd come to the stage in a golf cart, and they would help him up. And he'd, you know, slowly walk to get his guitar. But once he put his guitar strap on, as witnessed in Pine Knob, you couldn't tell there was anything. But he was hurting, and they had a doctor out there with him, and he just was insistent on, you know, doing and finishing the tour. Didn't want to postpone it. So that was a great thrill to kind of, you know, the circle goes around, and it was great being with him and hanging out. Especially, he's one of the, you know, he's one of the real true rockers that had a great work ethic and really cared about his music and really cared about the audience, you know, the album prices. And he was a real special guy. Would just, I mean, you listen to some of the tunes, you know, the cover tunes they did, like Bobby Womack, or, you know, some of the English stuff, you know, the Kinks or the things. I mean, they just did them so well. Check out Tom and the Heartbreakers doing Bobby Womack's I'm in Love. It's just, it gives me goosebumps. And, you know, to kind of be right there, you know, they did to Bobby Womack and some of the early rock stuff what the Stones did. They just really were able to kind of make it their own. So they were special for me.
Peter Wolf also told us that he's working on a memoir, which he hopes to publish in the near future, as well as a new album, which will be his 9th as a solo artist and first since A Cure for Loneliness in 2016.
Well, you know, I'm so committed in with the solo and the band. There's such a tight brotherhood, and I do a lot of my favorite Guile songs in it. And I'm in the midst of, I know people say this all the time, writing a book, but it's not going to be one of those. I grew up, and it's just going to be me and my, like, sort of I am a camera and my experiences with all the great musicians and people that I idolized and had encounters with, from the Stones to Sly Stone to Bobby Womack to Petty and Dylan and all of that. So I'm working on that, and I there's no plans for anything with the Guiles, unfortunately. It's sort of everybody seemed to have gone their ways. For me personally, very, very sad. I sort of was, people think I left the band, but that wasn't the case, and I don't think a Pine Knob tribute, it's the place to get into it, but there's more to it, unfortunately. I was hoping that the band could and would stay together, but there were great musical divides. I guess that was the main reason.
That's it for this episode of Hello Pine Knob. You can catch other episodes wherever you get your podcasts, including Odyssey.com and via 313presents.com. For more information about Pine Knob's 50th anniversary season, brought to us by United Wholesale Mortgage, Trinity Health, and Ally, and all of 313 Presents events, visit 313presents.com. I'm Gary Graff. Thanks for listening.
Make money from your podcast with the Odyssey Creator Lab. You create the show, we bring the advertisers. Apply now at creators.odyssey.com.